Welcome to the Hillbilly Hunter Podcast, where we talk hunting, fishing, and conservation through the unique lens of being born and raised in the Appalachian Mountains and adventuring throughout North America. So our guest today is our very good friend, Terry Burns. Terry got his humble starts here in Appalachia as a hillbilly like the rest of us. And then he got a big, fat taste for adventure at a very young age. So, Terry, glad to see you home.
Oh, glad to be home. Very glad to see you guys. Good afternoon.
Terry's home nowadays is on a fishing boat somewhere in the Pacific. We're not sure where he's at most of the time other than Gulf of Alaska, or now he's down south around Van Nuys, California, fishing for squid.
Well, I can relate with that. I often don't know exactly where I'm at either.
Right. So I'll send Terry texts occasionally, and be a month before I get a response. So as long as I get a response, I know he's not at the bottom of the ocean.
Sorry about that.
But Terry's got a unique story. He was born and raised in Appalachia, and like I said, he took a huge taste for adventure, and at a young age, left the area. And where'd you end up first?
Oh, first, when I was 21, drove to Cooper Landing, Alaska, on the Kenai Peninsula, south central Alaska. That took a little over a month. I went through 36 states, went down to the Mexican border, and four Canadian provinces, and then ended up in Cooper Landing, Alaska.
And then while you was in Cooper Landing, you had a, we'll call it a job. I don't think it was a job. you were employed.
I was employed. It's not work if you enjoy it, and I really enjoyed it. But, monetary gain was not the principal reasoning behind that employment. But it was wonderful, guiding recreational fishermen on rivers and lakes around that area in the mountains, Kenai Mountains. Getting to my principal hike was 3.5 miles to a waterfall with a lot of salmon and bears, a lot of brown bears. And that was part of the attraction. Show folks eagles and brown bears and salmon. So, yeah, it was great, great lifestyle for a while. And then got a little tiresome after a while. Got a little slow in that area, and I decided I want to go to the ocean. So I got in my car, had a Buick LeSabre, and drove down to Homer, Alaska, a couple hours away, right on the ocean, beautiful Cook Inlet and Kachemak Bay, and I spent about 3 months living in my car, living off the salmon that I had caught, and looking for jobs. And, that was in February, and I didn't have enough money to start the vehicle up and let the heater run, so and I had all my fishing gear in the car with me, so I couldn't lean the car back, and I couldn't sleep in the back seat, so I would sleep sitting up at the steering wheel until I got cold and would shiver myself awake, and then I'd get out, and I'd run around the car in the snow until I was warm enough to go back to sleep, and,
Now, that's pretty tough right there.
I don't know that tough is the proper adjective, but how bad do you want it?
That's right. That's it. That's how bad do you want an adventure? And I know we went up 1 year to Alaska. Me and Brian was going up to hunt. So, and we'd worked with Terry, so, I mean, since he was like 18 years old, so we knew him and kind of knew his backstory. So, got his number and gave him a call, and he came into Anchorage to meet us. And we'd already hunted, and we were getting ready to come home, so we had a hotel room, and he come to visit. So we go out in the parking lot and meet him, and you could tell he's living in his car. It was obvious.
There was no doubt whatsoever.
Yeah, there was no doubt he's living in his car. Yeah. And when he pulled in the parking lot, the right front wheel was kind of wobbly. I mean, it was he drove it there, so it'd been there.
Yeah.
It had 1,000,000 miles on it.
And there was something about you just turned over some
turned
of
over
gas.
Some gas.
Oh,
yeah.
Do
you remember that?
You guys were going to remember
that.
Oh, yeah, we remember that.
Yeah.
I'm afraid I lost a few brain cells to that whole issue. That was unfortunate.
So, yeah, he came in and hung out with us a while. And we actually convinced him to stay in the room because our flight left at, like, midnight. So we just convinced him to stay in the room that night because it had continental breakfast, and he looked like he might have been a little hungry.
You convinced me. I never do this. You convinced me to take continental breakfast for the road.
Yeah. yeah. Yeah, so he's he's lived a very adventurous lifestyle. And he was telling us a story here a little bit ago about a mountain goat hunt he went on. That's very interesting. So tell us a little more about that mountain goat hunt, Terry.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I'm glad you brought up the living in the car part. That was
That always makes you
lots that
reminisce.
We're jumping over, but I figure we can jump back to some of that. So, yeah, let's fast forward 3 years or so, and I'm no longer living in my car, which is a big upgrade. Now I've got a nice tent that I'm going to be backpack style hunting out of. I very much enjoy that type of thing. So I took my truck on the ferry because I was living in Homer. And so you drive on the this 300-foot vessel. They lock the truck down. It's about 83 miles to town of Kodiak across the out of Cook Inlet and then into the Gulf of Alaska. And I flew out from the town of Kodiak, and I conducted a 17-day mountain goat hunt.
17 days.
Which the pilot I flew with had been down there for 37 years, and he'd never taken anybody out for that long. So that was interesting. That got my attention. But the goats that I was after, I told him I wanted to hunt unpressured mountain goats. It was the end of October, getting ready to come into November. The weather's pretty rough down there that time of year. And that particular year, we had a series of typhoons settle in on the island, which will come into play later in the story. That's how it started. Great guy, great pilot. I've known him for a few years at the time. And I was traveling down there with a dear friend of mine, then we split up once we got there. So bushwhacking down there, for anyone that hasn't experienced it, I'd like you guys' input on describing bushwhacking through Alder and Devil's Club. And
it sucks.
It sucks beyond sucks. You can take the thickest, most thorn-filled piece of ground you've ever been in and multiply it by 50. And that's what climbing up some of this stuff around Kodiak's like.
And then
it sucks.
It does that. And to the point where, and, you know, it's all on about a 38-degree grade where I was at. It rains about every day there, so it's slick. And
just about like here. So that's what you're hearing right in the background.
What you're hearing in the background's rain. Yeah,
I think I probably brought it from Kodiak, unfortunately. It followed me. So, it gets to the point where you're no longer walking on terra firma. The alders, they grow parallel to the ground and then
yes,
up.
They do.
Yes, they do.
So you don't even get the pleasure of walking on the ground. And I was carrying about a 90-pound pack.
God, oh.
Which I was carrying a bow and a rifle.
90 pounds.
It's,
I went out with a girl one time that didn't even weigh that.
Yeah, I can't get too many ladies to agree to go on some of these trips. I can't imagine.
I can't either.
I would say
but
not.
Now, in that 90 pounds, yes. How much of that was food?
Oh, probably that trip. Probably about 56 pounds, I would suppose.
Yeah. Okay, and all that was for freeze-dried food.
Yep, a lot of that, a lot of like peanut butter, very dense. I try to pack food that is 100 calories per ounce. That's the algorithm I'm looking for. Anything over that, I want high in fat. And just to tell you how wonderfully well that algorithm worked, in 17 days I lost 31 pounds. And I didn't really feel like I had that to lose, just so you know, you get in your mind. I came back at 183 pounds, and I'm like 6'5", 6'6", so 183 is not what you're looking to be.
No.
Maybe a little skinny. So another thing about Kodiak, there's an amazing population of Kodiak coastal brown bears, which I certainly met a few on this trip. So from the moment I was dropped off. It was raining. It was windy. It was about 30 knots when I got dropped off. And it took me 2 days to get all my gear up to Alpine, you know, bushwhacking, going through alders, climbing over alders, dodging bears. There was a few instances where you glass ahead of you in any little opening, and there was a sow and three cubs in one area, so you got to let them go through and then deviate your course.
Absolutely.
Which isn't that much fun, because it's pretty difficult going. You just want to get where you're going. Can't see anything, can't see your hand in front of your face, can't breathe, you don't feel like, but it really makes you appreciate the destination. So kept going, got all my gear to tree line, and then it's not that tall. The area that I was in was probably 3,400 vertical feet, you know, these first ridges that I was on. So then had a general idea from the pilot of where the goat should be. So spent the next 3 days getting to that particular mountain range.
Wow.
It was all total from where I was dropped off, where I finally got on the goats, was probably 20-odd miles, which is not necessary, it turns out, but I wanted to go to this...
20 miles one way.
It was four ridges.
Wow.
Four separate mountain ranges, so I just wanted to be where people had not been. You know, there's not that much pressure down there, but the animals do see people, and I like going where they haven't. So that's what I set out to do. And you know, it's pretty steep walking. It's very steep and rocky, and it's so beautiful. You know, I just wanted to stop and take it all in from time to time, so I did that. And see deer and foxes and, you know, lots of bird life. So I like to stop and take that in, take a few photographs, work my way to the area I thought the goats would be. And then one evening I arrived at a good campsite, put my tent up, go around the corner, and there's a herd of goats on the mountainside about 3/4 of a mile away, starting to get dark, so I crawl out. Wake up the next morning to, I don't know, a foot of snow.
Golly, man.
And about 10 feet of visibility.
That's not good on the mountain.
Not good. Not good. And where I was camped was about the size of a typical, well, it was a little smaller than this table we're sitting at here. I forgot to mention that. Some nights I would just sleep on top of the briars because I couldn't get to the ground. So I'd just pinch my tent, I would tie it to the alders, and I would sleep sort of vertically because I couldn't get in. This one night in this area, I found this nice little half the size of a kitchen table area, flat area, so that's where I put my back. And I tied myself off. I drove a stake into the ground with a rock, and I tied a line through my belt loops and to this stake, three stake system. So I've got these stakes, and I've got them tied off to my belt loop. And I finally sort of fall asleep, and I must have shifted, and I fell off of that little ledge. And I woke up, and I felt something run down my face, and I realized I was on my knee. You know, my nose was on my knee.
Golly.
I put my hand up, and it's blood. Like, well, that's unfortunate. What had happened is I rolled off, and I fell down the slope, and my stakes caught me, thankfully, because about 600 vertical feet to the next flat. And I busted my nose on my knee, which, you know, please don't think less of me. I know it's not everybody's definition of fun, but I just wanted to, you know, when you're passionate about mountain hunting, there's nothing like it. You know, how bad do you want it? The more you put into something, I believe the more you get out of it.
Right, yeah.
I'm not as strange as this sounds, not a super huge fan of comfort. I find that weakens the mind and takes power from the heart. So I like
wow, that's like a, yeah,
that's really deep. I mean,
that is really deep, right?
That's
there.
A profound statement, and it is very true.
Well, yeah. When you spend because 17 days on the mountain by yourself, you get time to think about
it. Yeah,
profound.
I mean, with misery comes appreciation when you're on a mountain chasing a critter. I mean, really.
Yeah, I mean, really it like usually does.
I mean, because it's not, if it was easy, there wouldn't be any of them left.
Right. And it wouldn't mean anything to
right.
you.
Right,
you
yeah.
appreciate it when you work for it, the more you put into it. I like that. Misery brings appreciation.
Yeah, I'm going to have to write that down.
Yeah, because I'll not remember it in 5 minutes. So. Yeah.
And he's a published author. So.
That's true, he is.
Yeah, yeah, it really ain't that big of a deal.
It is to
yeah.
me. I'm
to move on.
All right,
let's
back
get
to
back
misery.
To the mountain goat hunt.
All right, back to mountain goat misery. So, yeah, so that's the kind of thing I'm doing. So I woke up and I was weathered in, which is very difficult for me. I'm there to experience things. I don't like being stuck in a tent. So I took that day and a half to go through my gear, consolidate, kind of make a little spike camp, make sure I've got the, you know, vitally necessary,
yeah.
you know, items.
Little food, little water.
That's it. You know, like a emergency blanket and that kind of thing.
One bullet in the gun for yourself in case you need it.
You always
yeah.
leave one.
Yeah.
So I, you know, the conditions have deteriorated pretty good. Now there's about 40 knots of wind. It's...
Now, how fast in layman's terms is 40 knots?
Oh, somewhere around 46, 47 miles an hour.
All right, so we're gusting 50.
Oh, yeah. Yep, easily. Which isn't that, I mean, you know, you deal with that when you go to Kodiak. You don't shoot long range, or I don't, personally. And it was hovering, the temperature most of the time was in the 20s. Sometimes up to the 30s, sometimes down to, you know, 10 degrees or so. So with 40 knots of wind, that's not overly warm.
No, you're down below, well below zero in wind chill.
Yep. So lots of wool clothing, lots of wool layers, which are heavy. You know, that's I've since upgraded my gear because wool is pretty heavy to be climbing a mountain with.
Yep.
But, you know, that's what I had back then.
Right.
Always trying to upgrade the gear. So the weather lets up a little bit, and I sneak around this point, and there is a finger ridge at about 4,000 feet elevation, knife edge, cliffs all around it. 330 yards is the closest I could get. I climbed there for a quarter mile, crawled on hands and knees on a goat path that was half as wide as my boot. And I sat there for the next 3.5 days. I would crawl back just a little bit, get something to eat, crawl forward, you know, just shaking, mildly hypothermic the whole time. Because it'd warm up, it'd rain, then it'd snow and get cold. And pretty rough conditions, but it was fascinating. You know, you get to see the hierarchy of the goats, and, you know, the big billies are up on top of the mountain, and you get... The nannies will be in a certain area and the kids will be in a certain area. And it was really fascinating to me to watch these things. You learn a lot. You see that they're on the windblown ridges because that's where the food is available because there's less snow there compared to everywhere else. So I sat there for 3 days wondering how in the world. I'm 6 days from my drop-off point. If I harvest an animal, it's going to take me 6 days, I figure, to get it out of there.
Golly, 6 days.
Which is, well, the snow conditions have really hampered my traveling, and I'm getting weaker by the day.
And well, it sounds like it. If you lost, 31 pounds?
31 pounds. And
that's a lot for like 17 days.
It was. Not healthy.
No.
That's 2 pounds a day.
It was, and I didn't feel like I really had that to lose to start with. That's the Kodiak Island Fitness Center. That's the real deal. So I'm wondering I've got 1 day left, I figure, that I've got 1.5 days left, and then I've got to get it done, or I've got to find some goats closer to access, because I told them 17 days, and it was a battle to let them, to have them let me stay out there that long by myself. So they didn't much like that. So... got a day left, and I'm watching the herd just like I have been. I'm up before daylight in position, and I don't leave until after it's gotten dark. So I crawl in, and I'm watching, and they're right in the same similar area. They've got everything they need there, so there's no reason to leave. And then I notice this sub-adult boar, male coastal brown bear. he comes out of the valley and he charges straight up the hill. I had no idea at the time that you would find a brown bear in goat country. I didn't know that that was a thing.
And even that time of year, being that late, you'd think they'd be
hibernating
somewhere to hibernate, yeah.
Which, come to find out, most years, that's one of the reasons the Kodiak brown bear can get so large, is many years they do not hibernate necessarily at all.
Right.
You know, if they can find food, ample food, which with all the deer and the goats there on that island, and late runs of salmon, they will stay, you know, awake and just feed, which is why they get so large. So, November, he's climbing around, and he starts spooking the goats. And they just go higher up on the cliff, and it was just a National Geographic moment, you know, with this bear. Something that was very rare to me is he climbs this cliff, and he falls. And oh, my goodness, you know, they're very aware. They know what they're capable of. Well, the conditions were such, you know, ice and snow, that he slipped. And then he starts going up the scree slope, and it was so steep that he just slide back down while he's trying to walk forward. It was just fascinating to watch. So he gives up after about 40 minutes, and the goats don't even look alarmed. They know that they're fine. So they go back to feeding after he leaves. 2 hours later, this sow, old-looking sow with two mature-ish cubs. They won't be around, you know, I figure next spring she'll kick them out. So she comes in from above. She's played this game before, and that very much upsets them. That's scary. They're not used to anything coming in above them. So they all take off running. Well, they don't know it because I've kept the wind in my favor for 4 days. They run right at me. And I'm watching this herd, and I'm just going, yeah, well, then the bears start coming. So then I'm like, oh, well, this is really getting interesting quick.
Yeah. I'm going to shoot a goat, and a bear's going to eat it before I can get to it.
Yeah, and then I'm going to have to keep that one bullet for myself. So this is just really lovely. I've sat up here for a couple weeks to make this happen. Great. So I watch very intently, and it's very steep territory. You know, they're all on paths that are, you know, they're no wider than your human hand. So they're scurrying around. It's amazing to watch goats in goat country. You guys have seen it.
Yeah.
It's a wonder. You know, it's a gift to get to see those things. So they all take off running right at me, and then I lose sight of them. Well, then I completely lose sight of the whole herd. You know, there's 30 animals, and I can't see one of them. Well, this, which is a pretty large herd, you know, that's a big band, because they were just untouched, nothing to bother them, no hunters and such. So I can't see the goats. I'm concerned about the bears. You know, they're coming at me. They're closing the distance. They're less than 100 yards. So I stand up and I wave at the bear. I've got snow camo. I've got whites on. I look just like a goat is my aim. So I open my whites up and I've got, you know, brown on. I start waving it, and the sow looks at me. And above tree line, they're pretty skittish down there for whatever reason. So she gets the cubs, turns around, and goes right back the way she came up over the mountain. Don't see her again. So now I'm, you know, I get my whites back on. I'm hunkered down. I'm looking around, looking up above me, because I know there's no way the goats went down low. So I'm scanning above me, scanning above me, scanning above me. There's nothing, you know, which it's not that easy to find a white dot in a sea of white. You look for the black of the horns and black of the nose. So I'm like, whatever. I'm going to climb to the edge of this cliff, and I'm going to look down. And there's no way there's a goat below me. I look down, there they are. Oh, all right. So they're about 230 yards down, which is, that's as good as it's ever gonna get. I've been sitting here for 4 days, and this is by far the best opportunity I've had. The wind's in my favor. It's let down, it gusts, and then it lets off. So I've set my pack up, and I'm shooting a Ruger Model 77 338 Win Mag with a loophole 3x9x40 scope, and got it across the pack. 210 grain nozzle partitions. Looking at the first deer, they're kind of skittish because they've been through a lot today. So I'm looking for the first. There was one absolute dandy giant billy in the group, and I'm looking for him, looking for him. Don't see him. A nice representative billy stands up, and he's broadside to me. I'm right above him. 200 yards, all right, that's good enough for me. Not a giant goat by any means, but any goat to me is a true trophy. And
especially when you spent all that time getting there and then sitting in the rain. And
losing weight.
Losing weight and hypothermic. And
makes you appreciate it.
Absolutely.
Makes you appreciate the moment. So the angle I was at, he was broadside to me, but I could see, I could visualize that if I put it between his shoulders, because as we all know, they are unbelievably tough.
Yes, they are.
Yeah.
To a point that it's almost mythical. I mean, a perfect shot on them seems to do nothing. And there's not a whole lot of flat ground here. I want to anchor this animal. And I've honestly, other than this particular instance, I don't know of anyone that's ever dropped one. And I was only able to drop this one because I was directly above him, shot between, right between both shoulder blades. It went through his spine, his heart, his lungs, and out his brisket. And, you know, it went through both shoulders and spine and everything. And he went straight down. And, you know, I couldn't believe it. I was very thankful. Rack another round in case the bears come back. They often do it a gunshot. And then out stands that giant Billy. That,
of course.
Of course.
Of course.
He was 40 yards closer to me up higher on another flat right below me, and I had no idea. And I had two tags. I had two mountain goat tags. That is a possibility for a resident of Alaska. You can, at the time, you could have two registration permits. I'm going to have my hands full getting one goat out of here. I just bowed to him and wished him a long life. I hope you turn into an 11-incher, buddy.
Yeah.
So I go down, and as the sun's, you know, as the sun's going down, take a few pictures, get started dressing it all out, and then I start getting out of there. I'm like, okay, there's a lot of bears in the area. So I go back to my camp, and I'm far above tree line, so there's nowhere to put any meat. So, you know, it's not going to spoil. It's 20 degrees, so that's not an issue. And so the best I could do was bury it in the snow and the rocks downwind, a couple hundred yards downwind of my tent. That's what that's what I've been taught. I worked pretty hard for that goat. I'm not going to let a bear have it. This is stupid. Don't recommend this to anybody. So I'm in like a one-man bivy bag, no real room. So I put it right outside my tent. That way, if anything, on the downwind side, you know, a couple yards away, that way he's not going to be chewing on me. He's not going to step on me while he's chewing on my goat. But he's close enough that I know he's there. So that's what I'm going to do. And I'm hungry, so I'm eating goat like it's going out of style. Just goat, goat, goat. I burn up 2 days' fuel just eating goat. And I'm very thankful to have it. Go to sleep. Sleep really well. Wake up. Pack up camp. Pack up meat. Take a look around. Go get water when I'm on my way back from getting water. I look on the ridge above camp. Well, that's pretty strange. I can't imagine anybody would be driving a Volkswagen Beetle down this mountainside. What is this? And it's still to this day the largest brown bear I have ever seen.
Wow.
And he's 120 yards away, and he has me pegged. So he comes down the mountainside, and I'm yelling, and I had my camera on my neck, so I turned it on video, and I'm yelling, I'm screaming, I'm thinking he's gonna charge. I want proof that he was really, you know, I had to defend myself.
Right.
So he comes down the mountain, I'm yelling, screaming, he's just looking at me. So I take the .338, which is a very loud firearm, and I wait till he's about 80 yards away, 70 yards away. Okay, that's enough. He's not going to deviate his course. So about 10 yards to the side of him is a large stone. I shoot the stone. It blows up all over the place. I think, all right, great. He's going to walk away. He looks at me, looks at the stone, looks back at me, and keeps walking my way. All right, this is getting serious. So he walks about another 10 yards, and then he just deviates and disappears. Oh, no big deal. So now the winds have returned. I know he's around. I know he'll be back. I try to hide the meat that I can't fit in my pack the best I can. and start out, you know, start hiking. Well, I hike for a while, and I stash some meat, come back, get some more, stash some meat. And he has, I chase him away again. I show up, and they say, don't do that, you know, let them have whatever they're on. I've worked pretty hard for this guy. If I can get him away from it, I had a front shoulder that had had a little bit of bloodshot damage, and I put it where he would come to it first if he came downwind. Not a sacrificial piece, but he'll come to first.
Yeah, if you're going to have to waste a piece, you'd bloodshot. Yeah.
Right. So I set that to the side, and he finds it, and I chase him off of it. He's had a few bites of it, no big deal. Put that in the pack, take off. And I noticed he tracked me a little ways. So we're all familiar with a mountain house freeze-dried meal. I put one of those full packages in his track, and it didn't touch anywhere.
Wow.
So, yeah, that's huge.
Crossways?
Yes, sir.
Wow, that's a big track.
It was to me. He's a big guy.
That's
big
at least 9 inches.
Yes, sir. I figured it for 10, and there was a guy the next year went in there, and he shot a 10'6" brown bear on top of a mountain not far from there.
I'd say
that's your buddy.
That's kind of what the pilot figured, because he was a very distinctive, very dark brown bear, and he had a light patch on his hump. And that's this bear did too, so I figured that was the guy. But anyway, so I'm hiking, and it's pretty windy, and it's now a couple days after I've shot the goat, and it's about 80 knots of wind now. The typhoon set in. It's painful. It feels like you're being sandblasted. And so I've got this large pack, about 100 pounds in my bag, you know, a lot of wind, you know, resistance. And I come around, there's this, where two ridges kind of converge, and there's a bit of a saddle above it. And I've got to make a turn there, right-hand turn, and go out the one ridge. Well, as I'm making that turn, well, a phenomenon they call willywaw, you know, where the wind will go over the ridge and then immediately down following the valley. I didn't account for it. And it was far stronger than the sustained 80 I had been walking on. I'm walking on a path, again, as wide as my foot. It catches my pack, and I go tumbling off the side of the mountain. Thankfully, there's some snow, and I fell about 35 feet. A couple little yard sales, little flips.
Wow.
Some gymnastics. Do a couple rolls down the mountain, come to rest. You know. Whew. So as I'm, I say come to rest, as I'm flipping, you know, all you can see is gray-white, gray being the sky, white being the snow, gray-white. I don't know which way is up. I know it's bad. There's not anything but steep country all around me. I just stick my two trekking poles out in the air, and they catch in the snow. I almost bent them both in half. They almost both broke. I still got them. They're in terrible shape. So, you know, they've been, whew, that was exciting. Get up. And again, I'm 6 feet away from a 600-foot drop. That's pretty disturbing.
So absolutely.
Get my stuff back together, put my pack back together, grab my stuff, go back up the mountain, start again. So that goes on for a few more days, and he keeps following me. Everywhere I go, everywhere I try to sleep, so I don't sleep much, because everywhere I sleep, he's there. He's there. He gets a hold of that shoulder again. And I get it away from him again, which is a dangerous proposition. I don't enjoy doing that. So, you know, I keep going, not sleeping much. The weather gets worse. They told me that there were sustained winds over 100 knots in that area.
And that's about how much in?
Well, that's over 100 mile an hour.
Yeah,
right?
It's
120?
It's about 118, I'd suppose.
That's like hurricane force.
Yeah, that's hurricane force winds.
Well, so we kind of laugh up there, you know. I'm a commercial fisherman. We go to work in storms that people name down here. You know, in the lower 48, those storms are named. We call it Tuesday.
Yeah, and not because it's a T name. It's just a day of the week.
It's just another day. So, yeah, it was brutal. It's to the point where it's actually very scary. You know, you go to pick up your backpack, and you feel like you got to fly off the side of the mountain. Like, I leaned at, you know, 35 degrees into the wind that supported me. that's pretty scary. You can't hear anything. It hurts. It's painful. You know, you get earaches. You get windburn. You get sandblasted with snow. I haven't been dry in 2 weeks. Like, it's pretty rough. You everything gets frozen. That's why you wear wool. If you wear cotton, it doesn't insulate you. Doesn't keep you warm.
Yeah. All right, cotton kills.
And that's a big mantra up there. And so that continues and fairly uneventful. You know, other than all of that.
Yeah, fairly uneventful.
Other than a grizzly tracking you and falling over the mountain.
Falling over the mountain and 120-mile-an-hour winds. But other than that.
Other than that, not bad. Not a bad 17 days on Kodiak. I mean.
Lost 31 pounds.
Yeah. And so, if you've never been on a hunt like that, where it's you and Mother Nature, especially in that country, you are going to be wet. You will not dry out. So you're going to bed wet, you're getting up wet, you're cold, and you're going to be hungry. Because, like you said, you had 50-some pounds of food.
It was not enough.
So if you'd went to Kroger's or some grocery store and bought 50 pounds of food, of whatever it was, it would have lasted you a week or so.
Right.
You know.
Maybe not even that.
Maybe not that. But you'd have had 3 meals a day and been decently satisfied. But eating freeze-dried food. It's not very satisfying. It's caloric, and it will keep you alive.
That's all any of my gear does.
And that's all it does.
I'm not looking to be comfortable out there.
To be efficient. I mean, you can't freeze dry a lot of things, and what you can freeze dry is it's high calorie, a lot of it's high fat and high carb.
And loaded with a salt.
Loaded with sodium.
It's got sodium.
And it's basically fuel to burn, and that's it. That's it.
And you're burning so many. It's so hard to explain how many calories you're burning out there. If you haven't experienced that kind of trip, I recommend you give it a try. But
it is nothing but work, basically.
It's work. It's all work.
You are actually humping. From the time that you wake up to the time that you lay your little head down, and you're just getting it. And you're usually wet, you know.
And cold. Burns a lot of calories.
Yep.
Yeah.
You're always very aware.
Yeah, and you're not going to get dry unless it gets dry right outside.
Yep.
Which, in that territory, doesn't happen often.
Right.
Not that time of year. Not the time of year you're up there. You know, you're always aware, you're always on point, you're looking for, you know, the animals that you're after. There's so many things to be aware of.
Yeah, there is.
And a lot of those places up there, there's stuff, you're not the highest mark on the food chain.
No, not by any means.
No, I don't think you are anywhere up in there, really.
Not really.
If you really think about it.
Anywhere there's bears, you're not the highest mark on the food chain.
And, that's even kind of right in this area here. You know.
Oh, yeah, you'd take a 150-pound black bear. There's no man that strong.
No. He will cut you to shreds.
Yes, he will.
Oh, so where I had been wet, my feet had taken quite a beating, and that terrain, I cannot overstate how steep that is. You guys have been up there. It's scary.
It is scary.
If you're not scared, I don't want to be with you.
I agree.
Yeah,
you know, I try to do it every single year. I try to do at least one or two, you know, several week-long mountain hunts. I'm scared every day. Not scared to the point that it's crippling, but very well aware that it's very dangerous. So in that, you know, you're desperate. Every step is desperate. There's nothing to grip. So you kick in. You know, I kick in the shale and the scree. I try to turn my foot sideways and make myself a step as I'm going up, especially with a heavy pack. And I develop what is called Christmas toe. And what Christmas toe is a deadening of the nerves from repetitious impact.
Blunt force trauma. I've never heard of that.
So you hear about it from, like, rock climbers or mountaineers, alpinists. And the reason they call it Christmas toe, they say if you get it in July, the feeling in your feet may come back by Christmas. So I got it in November, and I had mine back before I got in the boat. In April, I started getting my feeling back. So it's pretty wild. But so I get down, and I'm fighting the alders, and now I've got several trips. You know, it's taken me 3 trips to get the goat, I brought the hide out. So that's pretty much a trip in itself.
That's a trip in itself, yeah.
I've got the meat, and I've got my camp. Well, I've got some meat. I ate nearly half of that goat. I ate the inner loins, the back straps, one front shoulder, the majority of one hind quarter, and I had ribs one evening. And so not as much as normal that I had to carry out, but you have to carry all the bones because you have to prove to the state of Alaska that there's no wanton waste.
Yep.
You know, you're not.
You didn't leave anything behind.
So you got to take all the bones out. So I take, you know, I got a bag of bones and a bag of meat. So, which, you know, they were, my pilot was pretty impressed that I brought a bag of bones out. So you know, you're fighting the alders and you're taking multiple trips up. And in the lower elevations, it's raining very hard and it's hovering right around freezing. So not super lovely. And there's brown bears all over me. You know, I smell like blood. I smell horrific. And there's brown bears, you know, around every turn. I'm hanging everything. You got to hang everything in the trees, you know, and then you got to find a particular tree where you can approach it without being ambushed. It's got to be big enough to support the weight of the meat, but small enough that they know that they can't
get up in it.
Not going to be able to get in it. So, you know, a few days of dealing with that. And I get down and, you know, it's still very, very windy. There's a typhoon. Well, this pilot had been flying and I get there an hour after when I'm supposed to be there. My final trip, I've been on the beach for a day and a half, but to get to the certain point where he dropped me off, where he can easily access the area, I'm an hour late with my last trip. Well, he still hasn't shown up 4 hours after that, and it's starting to get dark. And it's very windy, and there's, you know, 3 and 4 foot white caps on the bay, the protected bay I'm in. And I'm starting to realize I'm going to be weathered in. I don't know how much longer I can take it because my feet, they're falling apart. Like, literally skin is coming off of them. They've been wet for so long, and now all this trauma, they've blistered to the point where flesh is completely exposed and pretty nasty scene, and I'm worried about infection and getting kind of worried about my situation, which doesn't happen very often. So it's like, okay. So as the sun's going down, I'm pulling all my gear back out. I'm going to have to set up camp. It's all soaking wet. I mean, like, there's puddles in my tent.
Oh, I guarantee it, yeah.
All my clothing's wet. And about then, I hear a low, oh, please. So, you know, you wait for the next 10 minutes. Like, is it him? Is it him? It was him. He had to fly the other side of Kodiak. He flew, circumnavigated the whole thing. He tried to go the direct line, couldn't make it, so he flew all the way around the outside of the island to stay in the leeward side of the wind. He flies in, he turns around, and he powers up away from the beach, like wind blowing towards me, because he can't get to the beach. So I have to get my gear, swim out to him, put it on his float, climb on the float, throw it in the back, swim back, get the rest of my gear. climb in the plane. I'm trying to ratchet the stuff down, you know, trying to throw a cargo net over it. And, you know, we're bumping, we're going up and down these waves. And he's like, yeah, I figured I'd better come out and get you. If I didn't get you today, it's going to be another 7 to 12 days.
Wow.
So, man, I wasn't going to make it. He's like, yeah, I figured. So here we are. He's like, you better buckle up for this one. So, I'm strapping this down. If somebody that's flown in Alaska for 37 years tells you to buckle up, you are in for one wild ride.
Absolutely. You better hold on.
So we're taking off. We go up the side of one big wave, and we never come back down. You know, now we're in the air. Cool. Great. So we're flying towards this point, and I'm focused on this point. We're jarring all over the place. My headset's falling off. There's stuff flying through the cabin. And then we're out of the protected bay. This mountain that was blocking the wind, it's no longer going to be a gentle ride. We're going straight for this point, and then all of a sudden we shift straight sideways. Still aiming towards the point, but now you can't even see that mountain. We've just been shoved sideways so far. So we turn into the wind. Bumpy ride, but we finally make it back. And then one last little very memorable point of that trip. There's 3 fast food restaurants on Kodiak. And there's a McDonald's, a KFC, and a Taco Bell. And they're in very close succession. And I bought 3 meals from each. And I ate all the meals, you know, as I was driving to the next place, I'd buy them while I was waiting in line. I'd eat them. And then I ate the last of it in my hotel room. I ate it all. It was terrible. It was disgusting. And then,
yeah, but it's way better than freeze-dried food.
Oh, it was nice. And to be in a bed and took like four showers. Yeah.
Yeah.
That was a memorable trip. Memorable trip.
Man, I tell you, that Terry Burns, he's one tough guy. 17-day mountain goat hunt. Anyway, this wraps up part number one with Mr. Burns. On the next episode, we're going to be talking about some of his travels to Africa, and you guys do not want to miss out on that one. So just as soon as that one is available, please go and listen to it. And once again, thanks for listening to the Hillbilly Hunter Podcast. Thanks for listening to the Hillbilly Hunter Podcast. If you would like to be a future guest on our show, drop us a email at hillbillyhunterpodcast@gmail.com.